Halfway through the next shift, an excited yelling echoed out of the mouth of the tunnel, and Nicholas hurried back down to the face. "What is it, Hansis?" he demanded in Arabic of the foreman monk. "What are you shouting about?" "We have broken through, Effendi." Hansis sheriff grinned at him, his teeth gleaming in his black and mud-smeared face. Nicholas eagerly pushed his way through the workmen. They had levered a huge round boulder out of the pack, and beyond it lay an opening. He shone his electric torch through this window in the wall, but could make out very little except empty black space. Stepping back, he slapped the monk on the back. "Well done, Hansis. A dollar bonus for every man in the team. But keep them working. Clear away all this rubbish." But it was not as easily done as he had ordered. The shifts changed twice more before the shaft was cleared completely of the last of the extraneous rubble and broken rock. Only then could Nicholas and Royan stand in the threshold of the cavern beyond the tunnel.
"What has happened here? What has caused this?" Royan's voice was puzzled, as Nicholas played his torch out into the void.
"I think this is a cave-in area. There was probably a fault in the rock strata running through here and here." He picked out the cracks in the roof of the cavern.
"You think the flow of the water through the shaft has scoured it out?" she asked.
"I would say so, yes." Nicholas turned the beam of light downwards. "The floor has fallen out of the shaft also." The rock had subsided in front of them, leaving a deep hole. 10 feet below where they stood, the hole was filled with water, forming a large circular pool with vertical rock sides. Overhead, the roof had fallen in, and was now a high dome of irregular rock, and the far side of the pool was shrouded in shadows 100 feet or more in front of them. There was no apparent way around this obstacle without entering the water. Nicholas shouted to Hansith to bring one of the long bamboo poles that they had used for the scaffolding. The pole was 30 feet long, and they had to manoeuvre its length down the tunnel. Nicholas sounded the pool with the bamboo, probing it down into the turbid water as deeply as he could reach.
"No bottom." He shook his head.
"Do you know what I think?" He retrieved the pole and passed it back to Hansith.
"Tell me," Rayanne invited.
"I think that this is the natural fault that leads the water away to the other side of the hills, and comes to the surface again at the butterfly fountain. The river has carved its own path."
"Why hasn't it drained, then?"
Royan looked down dubiously in the pool below them.
"A U-bend in the shaft, probably. Water still trapped in the top of the shaft like the bowl of a lavatory."
He probed the waters of the pool with the beam of his torch, and Royan exclaimed with horror and disgust as one of the giant eels came racing to the surface, attracted by the light.
"The filthy creatures!"
She stepped back involuntarily.
"The whole river must be infested with them."
The long, dark shape circled the pool swiftly and then disappeared back into the depths as suddenly as it had appeared.
"If you were right, and a section of Taita's adit has collapsed, then the continuation of his tunnel should be on the far side of this,"
she pointed across the pool, and Nicholas lifted the beam of the torch and shone it in the direction she indicated.
"Look! Nicky!" she cried. "There it is!"
The dark rectangular opening yawned at them from across the pool.
"How do we get across there?" Royan asked, disconsolate.
"The answer to that is not very easily, damn it to hell," Nicholas swore heartily.
"This is going to cost us another couple of days that we can ill afford. We're going to have to build some sort of bridge across it."
"What kind of bridge?"
"Get Sapper down here, and this is his department."
Sapper stood at the brink of the sinkhole and glared across at the far bank.
"Pontoons?" he grunted. "How many of those inflatable rafts have you got squirreled away?"
"Forget it, Sapper," Nicholas shook his head. "You're not getting those dirty great paws of yours on my rafts."
"Suit yourself,"
Sapper spread his hands in resignation.
"It would be the easiest and quickest way of doing it. Anchor a raft in the middle and build a catwalk over the top of it. I need something that floats high."
"Baobab!" Nicholas snapped his fingers. "That should do the trick very nicely. When it's dried out, baobab wood is as light as balsa. Floats just as well as one of my inflatable rafts."
"Plenty of baobabs growing along the hills," Sapper agreed. Every second tree in this valley seems to be a ruddy baobab. 300 yards from the top of the cliff grew a massive specimen of Adansonia digitata. Its smooth bark resembled the skin of one of the great reptiles from the age of the dinosaurs. Its girth was tremendous. 20 men with outstretched arms could not have encircled it. The upper branches were bare and twisted, and it looked as though it had been dead for 100 years. Only the heavy velvet-covered pods proved that it still lived. They hung thickly from the high branches, bursting open to spill the black seeds, which were coated thickly with white cream of tartar. The Zulus say that the Nkulukulu, the Great Spirit, planted the baobab upside down with its roots in the air to punish it, Nicholas told Royan, as they looked up at the enormous spread of its branches. Why would he want to do that? She wanted to know. What did the poor old baobab do that was so bad? It boasted that it was the tallest and thickest tree of the forest, and so the Nkulukulu decided to teach it a little lesson in humility. One of the gigantic branches had snapped off under its own weight and lay on the rocky ground beneath the trunk. The wood was white and fibrous, light as cork. Under Nicholas's direction, the axemen cut it into manageable lengths. Once they had been carried down the adit shaft to the sinkhole, Sapper stapled the logs together and floated them across the pool to form a causeway. He anchored this to the rock face at either end, and then over it he laid a catwalk of bamboo poles. The bridge of baobab logs floated high, and although it bobbed and swayed, it could easily support the weight of 12 men at a time. Nicholas was the first one across the sinkhole. He placed a roughly made ladder against the high vertical bank and scrambled up into the mouth of the adit on the far side of the pool. Royan was close behind him. The two of them stood in the entrance to this continuation of the shaft, and as soon as Nicholas shone his torch into it, they realized that the nature of the construction had changed. This section had not been so heavily scoured out and eroded by the rush of river water through it. The main flow must have drained away through the sinkhole. The dimensions were the same, 3 meters wide by 2 high, but the rectangular shape was more precise, and although the walls and roof were rough, like those of a mine, the marks of the tools that had shaped it were now clearly visible. The footing of the tunnel was roughly paved with slabs of crudely dressed stone. This whole length of the tunnel had also been submerged, for it lay below the natural level of the river before it had been dammed. The paving under their feet was wet and covered with a slime that had not yet had time to dry out, since it had been exposed by the receding waters. The roof and walls of the tunnel ran with moisture, and the air was dank and cold, and smelled of mud and rot. They waited for Sapper to string the cables for the lights across the causeway. He set up the lamps and switched them on. At once they were aware that ahead of them the shaft had begun to rise at an angle of about 20 degrees. You can see what the old devil Taita was up to here. He's taken us down well below water level to flood the tunnel to a length and depth that nobody would be able to swim along. Now he's angling up again, Nicholas pointed out to Royan. They started forward, moving slowly up the ascending shaft, and Nicholas counted aloud each pace he took. 108, 109, 110. Suddenly they came to the recent low river level. It was clearly marked as a dry line on the walls of the tunnel. The paving under their feet was also dry and free of the slippery coating of slime. 50 paces further on, they passed the high flood level of the river, which was just as clearly etched on the rock floor and the walls. Beyond that, the tunnel had never been immersed, and the walls were in the same condition as the Egyptian slave workmen had left them 4,000 years earlier. The marks of the bronze chisels were as pristine as if they had been inflicted just days before. Only 10 feet beyond the highest point that the river waters had ever reached, they came out upon a stone landing. Here the floor levelled out, and then the tunnel turned sharply back upon itself. "Let's spare a minute just to think about this as a feat of engineering." Nicholas took Royan's arm and pointed back down the tunnel. "Taita has placed this landing, on which we are standing, precisely above the high water mark of the river. How did he work it out so exactly? He had no dumpy level, and only the crudest measuring equipment, and yet he calculated it as accurately as this. It's a hell of a piece of work. Well, he tells us repeatedly in the scrolls that he is a genius. I suppose we will have to believe him now. She pulled against his grip. Let's go on. I must see what lies around this corner, she urged. Side by side, they turned through the 180-degree corner, and Nicholas held the hand lamp high, with the electrical cable trailing back down the shaft behind him. As he lit the way ahead, Royan exclaimed aloud and seized Nicholas's free hand. Both of them froze with astonishment. Taita had designed the turning of the ascending ramp for dramatic effect. The lower section of the shaft through which they had passed was crudely constructed, the walls irregular and undressed, the roof lumpy and cracked. Taita had calculated his levels so finely that he had known that the lower levels of the shaft would be submerged and damaged by the water. He had wasted no effort on beautifying them. Now before them rose a wide stairway. The angle of its ascent was such that, from where they stood on the landing, the top of it was hidden from their view. Each step stretched the full width of the tunnel and rose a hand's breadth. The treads were cut from slabs of mottled gneiss, polished and fitted to each other so precisely that the joints between them were barely visible. The roof of the tunnel was three times as high as it had been in the lower reaches of the tunnel, perfectly domed and proportioned. The walls and the curved roof were of beautifully dressed blue granite blocks, keyed into each other with marvellous precision and symmetry. The whole was a masterpiece of the mason's art, majestic and portentous. There was both a promise and a menace in this vestibule to the unknown. Its simplicity and lack of ornamentation made it even more impressive. Royan tugged softly at Nicholas's hand, and together they stepped onto the first tread of the stairway. It was carpeted with a fine layer of dust, soft and white as talcum powder. The dust rose in soft eddies and wisps around their knees, and then subsided as they passed onwards. It muted the harsh glare of the electric lamp that Nicholas carried high in his right hand. Gradually, as they went on upwards, the top of the staircase came into view ahead of them. Royan dug her fingernails into the palm of Nicholas's hand as she saw what lay ahead. The staircase ended on another level landing, across which a rectangular doorway faced them. They stepped up onto the landing and stood before the doorway. Neither of them had words to express this supreme moment. They stood in silence for what seemed like an eternity, holding each other's hand with a fierce and possessive grip. Finally, Nicholas tore his eyes off the gateway and looked down at Royan. He saw his own feelings mirrored in her face. Her eyes shone as though lit from within by an incandescent passion. There was no other person alive with whom he would wish to share this moment. He wanted it to last forever. She turned her head and looked at him. They stared deeply and solemnly into each other's eyes. Both of them were aware that this was a high tide in their lives, one that could never be repeated. She tightened her grip on his hand and looked back to the doorway facing them. It had been plastered over with white river clay, a surface that had mellowed to the shade of ivory. There was no crack or blemish in its smooth expanse, like the flawless skin of a beautiful virgin. Their eyes fastened avidly on the two embossed seals in the centre of the expanse of white clay. The upper one was in the shape of the royal cartouche, the rectangular knot surmounted by the scarab, the horned beetle that signified the great circle of eternity. Royan's lips formed the words as she read them from the hieroglyphics, but she uttered no sound. The Almighty, the Divine, ruler of the upper and lower kingdoms of Egypt, familiar to the god Horus, beloved of Osiris and of Isis, Mamoz, may he live for ever. Below this magnificent royal seal was a smaller, simpler design in the shape of a hawk, with one broken wing drooping across its bared breast, and the legend, I, Taita the Slave, have obeyed your command, Divine Pharaoh. Underneath the maimed hawk was a single column of hieroglyphics that spelled out the stern warning. Stranger, the gods are watching.
disturb the king's eternal rest at your peril.